Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
I go to pull the tubing off of the hot end and it wouldn't come off.
P.O. Showtime!
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing Tech Show, and that's fact. If you don't like the cats, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are licking bad. But the stream is good with the DLNTS.org and ICChallengeLinuxLink.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the gala's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 822 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Pat.
Howdy.
We have Flying Rich.
From the, Hughes Outpost Orlando Command.
And Joe.
Last but not least.
Nah, you probably won't be last. I think Joel said he's going to show up tonight, so.
Maybe.
His Uber Eats is probably late.
Right.
He might actually left the house.
Oh, no, he's cooking, and that's why he can't be on the show yet.
Dude, come on.
But he paid all that money to have that kitchen put in.
What? Nobody's cooking in that kitchen.
It's just for show.
That's where Uber Eats drops it off. They just had the window enlarged so Uber Eats could just hand it in to the, to the table.
That's terrible. That is terrible. He usually has something going on Wednesday night anyway.
Maybe he's bowling.
I thought it was over.
Yeah, I thought it was dead. I mean, over.
Dead.
I have no idea.
Hey, all right, so let me just launch into it, since I'm going to launch into it anyhow. I've done a couple of videos on the Raspberry Pi 4, and, like, the fan that a lot of people use on a Raspberry Pi 4 is a 40mm fan. And apparently you can buy these expensive ones that are quiet, but the normal cheap ones that somebody like me would buy are crazy noisy, at least to me. I'm annoyed by it. It's really... And so the Raspberry Pi 4, you got 4 chips on there. 3 chips you definitely need a heatsink, so the CPU, the Ethernet controller, and the USB controller need heatsinks. The memory, not so much, but you could throw them on there for good measure. So what I ended up with, I've had this like my third version. The Raspberry Pi has both 5 volts and 3 volts on the 40-pin header. Well, I found that if you get a bigger fan moving at a slower speed, the tip speed is where the noise is. You get less noise. So I got a 12-volt fan that's 60mm, and I'm running it at 5 volts, and you can't hear a damn thing. And it cools it, no problem. Even if you're doing load testing on it, it won't hit thermal throttling. So I'm pretty happy about that.
How does that fit? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Now, I have a friend that's also done, a couple of friends that have also done the fans on the Raspberry Pi 4. But they're all across the pond. So I just dropped the link that they had shared with me on what they recommend for cooling on the Raspberry Pi 4, and that's the fan shim for Raspberry Pi.
I don't have the... you dropped it in the IRC? Where'd you drop the link?
No, I dropped it in the mumble.
I just put it in the IRC.
All right, so let me check if I can see that, because I'm on the Chromebook here.
Yeah, Chromebook doesn't have a browser, apparently, right?
And from what I understand, this is a really easy setup because where the pins are, that's kind of what holds it in along with a couple of screws and gets everything lined up for you and set in the right spots.
Okay, but that still looks like it's in the 40mm size or maybe even 30mm.
Oh, let me see. I'm not seeing a measurement on it.
It's 30mm.
Yeah, I'm betting that's going to sound like a turbine engine under a pillow.
Wait, where do you have this thing set up?
What are you asking?
I'm asking you. You just said under a pillow. Is this in your bedroom?
I'm teasing. I said, oh. I bet a 30 millimeter fan probably sounds like a turbine engine under a pillow.
Right. Okay.
I've seen some thermal pictures otherwise. So, okay, if you look at that link you just posted, so it says without fan shim.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see the CPU is hot. Unfortunately, you got a little bit of a flare around it. You can't tell how hot the memory chip, which is the first one to the right, but the two smaller chips, that's, I think the top one is the Ethernet controller and the bottom one is the USB controller. Those suckers get hot.
I'm not even sure those two pictures are the same model.
Hold on, let me look. Yeah, it looks they both look like a Pi 4 to me.
Okay.
Yeah, you can tell by the micro USB, micro HDMI ports.
Ah, right. The two, well, okay, I guess it looks like three ports in a row there, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, it's the USB-C and then the two HDMI, and which was cool because my wife and I both had the Droid Bionic, which had a micro HDMI cord on it, micro HDMI port. So I had two micro HDMI to HDMI cables kicking around.
Yeah, I got a couple of tablets that use that. So I know I got the adapters lying around for when I finally get one, when Micro Center gets some of the 4 gigs in.
Yeah. So I thought Joel said that 4 gigs are more available. Anyhow, let me pimp my video. So if you go to flyingrich.com or if you're subscribed to my YouTube channel, I've got a video on my latest revision on the 60 millimeter fan, 12 volt fan running at 5 volts, and it's just stink silent. It's absolutely the best. I put one on the Odroid HC1 that I have because I had a 5 volt 60 millimeter fan that was kind of noisy, and I put one of them on it also. Because the box for, like, I don't know if it's $8.99 or $9.99, or forget what the price is, but you get four fans. You get four 12-volt fans for that price. So I picked up four.
Okay, I have a question.
Indeed, you do.
So this fan, the fan that you linked us to, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that it connects up and plugs into those pins, correct?
That's what it looks like.
So then what looks like screws on the side of the fan do not do anything.
I seriously doubt that they do anything.
Otherwise, they would be going through that one integrated circuit, and that would probably be terrible.
See, I'm looking at my Pi 4 right now, and there are no... All right, so those screws hold the fan to... That's probably... Together.
Yeah, okay.
So, to the carrier board, and not to the Raspberry Pi, because there are no holes in the Pi, you know, board.
No, okay, that makes sense. So now, does this fan sit over... I mean, is it flush to the processor then?
I'm not sure. I don't actually have one.
Based on the pin height, so we're the 40-pin header... It looks like it's just at the top of the pins.
Right. That's what I guess wondering.
I guess it depends if you have a heatsink on the, you know, how tall your heatsink is on the CPU.
This specifically says in the notes, not heatsink compatible.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, see, I would definitely throw a heatsink on because I think that's a big deal.
Does yours have a heat? Did you have yours with a heatsink, Rich?
Yeah, if you look, I did 3 videos on cooling the Raspberry Pi 4, so I got a packet of heatsinks that were pretty cheap, and so I got 3 heatsinks. I probably should throw a 4th one on, you know, one on the RAM, but I don't have one on the RAM right now. And I have no problems with thermal loading. It doesn't go to thermal throttling when I do a full load test on it. So I'm pretty happy about that. And it's stink silent. So there's this like ice tower cooler. I forget what it's called. But basically it's a heat pipe with a bunch of fins and a fan. And Dor just got one. He said it's quiet. You can't hear it. But it's like $20 plus shipping plus a long wait. So at least the stuff I posted, I got the links in the description below in the video. You can order them from Amazon. And you can get them pretty much tomorrow. So that's cool.
How does that, I haven't watched the video yet, and I was just about to just see if I could peek over there and look at it, but, so the fan is 60 millimeters, it's twice the size of the 30 millimeters, and I can see that 30 millimeter seems to fit almost like it fits in that spot there where the connector is. How, like, I take it the 60 millimeter has to be raised a bit higher off the board.
Right, so the 60 millimeter is a box fan, and the width of the Raspberry Pi board is probably like 56 millimeters, so the fan is actually wider than the board. There are some cases out there. I was looking at Thingiverse for 60 millimeter fans, and definitely 60 millimeter fan running at 5 volts, and basically my cooling solution, of if you divide it by 4, because you get enough for 4 Raspberry Pi 4s, is $450 for a Raspberry Pi. If you pay the full freight, so it's $18, and you got enough to do 4 Raspberry Pis.
Damn, I'm looking at it right now, and it's like a whole other single board computer with that fan attached to it, isn't it? that is a monster.
Well. And I'm thinking about, next to it in the video, if you see, I got the Rockchip 64 from Pine, and I have, it's a combination heatsink and two 40 millimeter fans. I'm thinking about popping that off and doing the same thing. Just throw independent heatsinks on and the 60 millimeter fan, you know, 12 volt fan running 5 volts. Because the two fans, so what's weird is sometimes you get harmonics from the two fans running together. Like, if you ever hear a twin engine airplane flying over, you know, that kind of thing, sometimes you get that going on, and it's a little maddening to me. So I'm thinking, you know, a single 60 millimeter fan might be real nice on that.
Yeah, isn't that a bit of overkill, though?
Oh, yeah, yeah, but running it at 5 volts, you know, running it at a slow RPM, you're not going to hear it. For whatever reason, and I don't know if it's an operating system problem, but it does report the Rockchip 64 running pretty hot. So I was kind of surprised at that.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that you were, like, right next to it and you couldn't hear it going at all in the video.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the last two, so one I shot at my house, and I had the, you know, camera up high in a boom, and I probably had the audio levels different. So it's not a one-for-one comparison on the 40-millimeter fan that sounds like a turbine engine, but it is a one-for-one comparison on the 5-volt fan versus the 12-volt fan running at 5 volts. That's a definite, that's the same distance within a couple minutes of each other. So that's a definite real comparison there. So if you have the least bit of background noise, you can't hear it when you're, you know, inches away from it. If you're, you know, standing 3 feet away, 4 feet away, you just won't hear it at all.
Did you drop a link to the video in the mumble?
No, but you could go to flyingrich.com and find it.
Why would I go there?
Because that's where all my social media be. And you get links to the Linux Link Tech Show and everything. Dan, did you drop the link?
I did. I dropped one of them in there.
Thank you, sir.
Dropped it like a turd.
Thank you.
Like it's hot.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got to get my 3D printer fired up and print a nice case for this stupid thing. And Joel, I didn't get to ask him, but he did mention that Raspberry Pi 4 4 gigs were getting more available. So I'm hoping I can pick one up. Pick another one up, that is.
I just checked the Micro Center website, and they still only have the 1 gigabyte and the 2 gigabyte available.
Dude, really? How many? I'm wondering what the sales numbers are.
Well, I saw somebody on Facebook Marketplace that was selling two of the 4 gigabyte models, but they were selling them for like $75 each.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, there's this one. So if you go to raspberrypi.org, there's this one place that sells them, and they're really ripping people off. Other places, you know, Canakit and Micro Center, they're very reasonable.
Yeah, Micro Center has it, you know, right at the price that's recommended. What is it? Yep. $55, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Canakit, yeah, they are selling it also at $55, but then they got like $15 or $20 shipping and handling.
Yeah, so, yeah, it wasn't awful, but it was okay.
Yeah, and then most of the other places that you go to, yeah, they got it at $55, but then the shipping and handling is adding to it. So I'm waiting for it to get to Micro Center, and I'm also hoping that there will be more development in the operating system front on what operating systems you can run other than Raspbian.
So I'll tell you what I was unhappy about. The cool thing about Raspbian is Raspbian runs on every Pi device.
Right.
And I'm hoping that changes in the future because the 3 and the 4 are 64-bit, so you're saddled with 32-bit. But and there's different models of processors. So whether it's an ARMv7, an ARMv8, it will run with those versions. So I was really hoping, I was working on a comparison video between the Rockchip 64 and the Raspberry Pi 4 with 4 gigs. Both of them have 4 gigs. And what I was going to end with was that SUSE Linux, which is out for the Raspberry Pi 3, but not the 4. There's no support for the Raspberry Pi 4. I was hoping it would be just like Raspbian, where it just worked. Because SUSE Linux, they have KVM built into it.
Well, the instruction set is different, isn't it?
Right.
For this particular processor, completely different than any of the other ones?
I don't know how completely different, but it is different.
Different enough that none of the non-Raspbian operating systems will work.
So I think ArmBian works because DietPi is based on ArmBian.
Okay.
So I would check ArmBian out.
Well, I think once somebody gets OpenELEC working on there, or OSMC.
I thought I saw, like, ETA Prime has a lot of good videos, and I thought I saw somebody with OpenELEC running.
That and RetroPie.
And I think he had some gaming videos too. So check ETA Prime for that kind of stuff, because he definitely had some videos on this.
Hey Joe.
Yeah.
If you're waiting for like Micro Center to get the Raspberry Pi 4 4 gig in stock, and it seems like you've probably been waiting a little while, why didn't you just order it online?
Two reasons, like I said, the one, the shipping, and two, I was letting things develop and other people get things done.
Okay. I get it.
But Joe's kind of smart that way. He doesn't have to pay the early adopter tax.
But I did almost buy that $75 one on Facebook Marketplace just because I really still want one and I wouldn't have had to wait for the shipping.
Oh, speaking of shipping, Dan, you sending me anything anytime soon? Not that I'm in a rush.
No, I was going to mention that. I'm done messing around with it, so I'm going to be sending it back to you. It was nice. I think if I were to get one and use it, I would probably use it with Linux on here, because I found the Android experience just a little too slow. Linux, a little bit better, but and the Linux ArmBian was a lot more versatile than the Android, so I had fun using it. But I'm going to be sending that back. Yes. Yes, sir.
Oh, so did you just run everything off micro SD?
Yes, I did. I didn't even explore attempting to install it locally.
Do you think Armbian was the best thing going?
Armbian was the only thing going. All right, let's get it straight. All right, Armbian was the only thing I could get running on here, and I don't know what the deal was. But that's the one. I had the success with it. I tried a few other things, and you know that's where I ended up, and I enjoyed it. It showed me, you know, what to expect from a device like this, the pros and cons of it, and I'll be interested to hear how the PineBook Pro, right?
Yeah,
stacks up in comparison.
And I think they're doing something. Dor sent me a link. If I was better prepared, I would have had the link available. I think Pine is looking for sponsors to sponsor Pine Books for giveaways to people in need. And I believe they said they're not making any money on the Pine Book Pro. They went down a list of devices on what they're making. They're making so little money on this stuff, it's crazy. And God bless them. I mean, they're a lot of fun toys out there from Pine.
Yeah, they're neat. And I would like to see more people competing in this market.
If you look at Armbian, you can scroll through and you see all the, you know, single board computers out there. Oh, you're talking about like the
laptop.
Pro?
Yeah, the whole laptop thing. Like,
well, you know, look at me. I got a 14-inch Acer for $200. You know, kind of end of life or end of sales life. And my wife just got a 15-inch with touchscreen and backlit keyboard that was a refurb, another Acer. And I'm trying to get one myself since I'm making all those mad YouTube dollars. A couple of months, I might be able to afford the $200 Acer Chromebook.
From Goodwill, when it doesn't have a hard drive?
Right, right.
It's $10. Yeah.
With all my mad YouTube dollars. No, it's kind of... I'm the kind of person that if I made a couple of dollars on YouTube, I'd be all sorts of happy. I was jealous of Tracy Holtz when he was telling me, like, yeah, you know, I make enough to pay for dinner for my wife and I out a month, you know? I'm like, oh, cool. Well, although the bad thing about YouTube is when you start looking at, like, it took me, you know, so many hours to shoot that video, so many hours to edit that video, and I made 22 cents on it.
But it was a labor of love.
Yeah, I guess.
22
you know,
times a million. You're the richest man in the universe now.
Yeah, so once you get monetized, then you start looking at how much money that one video, you know, made you versus the effort you put into it. And then you're like, really? Really, that's it?
That's how much YouTube values your content.
Well, you know, the effing of it was I qualified for monetization so I got monetized, I don't know, third week in July. I was eligible for monetization. I hit their thresholds September of last year. So they had me on the line for like, you know, 9 months.
Yeah, I remember when you hit the 1,000 mark.
Yeah, it was the 1,000 subs because I had the watch hours. For a long time. I think I had it for over a year, but I didn't have the 1,000 subs. And with that, I'm going to have to jump on a call and do Enterprise Tech Geekery.
All right, good luck. Have fun.
Guys, take care.
Good day, sir. Yeah.
Still no Joel.
No. He's going camping this weekend. So, I was going to say he didn't get eaten by a bear last weekend. Or maybe a different kind of bear in downtown Columbus.
Possibly.
Joe, I had a... Oh, man, this was a good one today. So, I was doing some streamlining on our pipeline and trying to get things better consolidated and reduce the number of extraneous scripts that had to be set up. These are largely Node.js applications. Well, primarily Node.js applications. And in the package JSON, we list out a lot of scripts for doing things like testing and building Docker containers and stuff like that. So you just run it with the npm commands. And we had a whole lot of testing issues. And trying to ferret out those problems, that was really interesting. A lot of deep diving and packet. We almost got to packet tracing. That's still on the table. We got to figure out how the hell we are going to do that. That is a tricky problem.
Package tracing?
Oh, no. So here's the situation, right? Which is kind of like leads into this problem too, but we have a suite of different tests that we perform on all our applications. There's this one application, our CMS, though, which has a lot more testing involved in there. So we've been running into a problem that, well, it's been around for a while, and finally got enough people to just say, hey, we got to figure this out a little better. But testing is great, right? Absolutely. You know, I agree with the whole write your tests, develop your code, test it. You know, testing is great. Testing is only as good as the test you write.
You mean you guys don't do your testing in production?
No, we're not. Well, that happens. But no, we try not to do that. But so when like you get really sloppy on your testing, you end up in like one of the worst case scenarios, and that is intermittent failures on your tests. Like you could run a test five times and it might succeed four times but fail the fifth time because of issues not really related to your code, but you know, you don't know what. It could be the network, it could be connectivity to a service, it could be whatever, you know.
Right, and possible data input issues.
Yeah, there could be a whole bunch of different things. So if you're not like paying attention to your testing and you start seeing like connection timeout errors, and your response to that is, well, we'll just increase the timeout, you know, that we have allowed for connectivity. No. And you know what, so if you're not like, if that's your solution to the problem and you keep having to do that, you got another problem that you need to look at. And eventually, and some of that is like where we're at today, right? Because some people
kind of like saying, we'll just keep increasing the virtual memory until it works just fine.
Right. So, you know, so now we're in a situation where we're trying to figure out, you know, why are these tests failing? What is it we need to do? And one of the jobs that I had, because people were so, and I spoke about this in the past, were so, you know, frustrated with this problem happening, and it would come and go. You know, it would be fine for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then you'd have 2 or 3 weeks of constant failures. And whenever you would have to rerun the test, you got to go through the whole pipeline process again. And part of that was originally building the image that would be tested in the container. But, you know, I did a lot of work to offload that so that you build it once and it's retained up in Quay and pulled down, you know, whoever uses the same configuration that would use that image, coordinate that image, would use that base image instead of having to rebuild it and push it up there again. But one of the problems that we ended up having was talking about the problem today.
You were mentioning an intermittent connection problem that caused timeouts. I'm assuming you're going to find out that it's a faulty switch.
Well, it's interesting. Interestingly enough, we think it might be a network pipe issue.
Right.
What it is is a container running in Kubernetes. So we have our Jenkins cluster is our containers on Kubernetes. And the weird thing about it is like you're technically running a container within a container, you know? So we have the slaves Jenkins slaves are running in containers, and you have a job that executes that builds a container to run some steps in, you know, so you got like that kind of weirdness going on. So then you have issues between the couch-based clusters and the RabbitMQ clusters and the solar cloud. So, and anyway, it's probably there's going to be probably a host of things, but also we had found out like some of the default settings on the couch-based client for Node didn't seem to follow their documentation, where we were seeing what should be a 2-second default timeout was actually running at 0 seconds, right? So if it tests different things to get connectivity to the cluster, and so if it doesn't succeed in this one method, it'll move on to the next method, and then the next method, whatever's available. But there's like a timeout in there that it should be by default 2 seconds, but seemed to be happening with 0 seconds, right? We don't know why that was or what was going on with that. We kind of adjusted that to set it at 2 seconds, and that resolved a lot of problems for that specific issue.
I imagine it would. I mean, 0 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
We also had trouble figuring out, because the part of the documentation is like, this value is set in seconds or decimals of a second. And then you read another part of the documentation, and that same value is set at milliseconds. And then you read a third part of the documentation. If you get down into the C code, it's set at microseconds. And I'm like, well, if we're setting it, you know, if we're setting it here at this value here, is that seconds and decimals? Is that milliseconds or is that microseconds? Because 200 milliseconds is, or microseconds is very different than 200 milliseconds, right?
Yes, it is.
So we had that. How you doing, Joel? But anyway, what it came down to today was, so we had moved our CMS over to a fourth version of our pipeline. And consolidate some stuff and streamline it and get it going out there. And I wanted to move the other applications over. And I came down to this, you know, I got every single application over except for this one was failing testing. I had a failed testing locally, and I was like half paying attention to it. And I got it, like I figured out, like, oh, I had a typo. And it was because I was doing it locally, whatever. But that shouldn't be a problem up there in Jenkins. And it was failing Jenkins almost in the same way. Over and over again, it was failing. And then I realized why it was failing, and that's because what we were doing, as explained in the past, during a testing, building a container, mounting the current working directory, which is the root of the repository, on the Jenkins slave, which is running in a container, interesting enough, as a volume into the container that we use for testing. And that line was not in there in the testing execution, so it wasn't mounting that container in there for local testing, right? But it was fine out there in Jenkins, and I solved that problem for local testing, figured out, and so I got it running, and lo and behold, tests are failing, and I'm like, this is ridiculous, because I didn't change anything in relation to the actual application code. It was just switching over to a different version of the pipeline, the continuous integration pipeline. And so I dig into it a little bit, and then I move on to something else, and I come back, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. This is we're having another one of these false positives in a test, right? It's intermittent failures, because yesterday it was passing, and today without any changes, it's not passing. So to verify this, I tested both in Jenkins and locally, got the same exact error in Jenkins and locally. So I went to locally the master branch, and I tested that, exact same error. And I went to the previous version, exact same error. No matter what version I was trying, exact same error. I kept going back, like 3 or 4 different versions, all the same error coming out. So I start thinking to myself, wait a minute, this sounds like a legitimate error, right? There's a problem here. This is not an intermittent failure. So how could it have been successful yesterday and failing today? And even if I go back to stuff that's like 2 or 3 weeks ago, that's even failing. It's got to be a data issue, right? It's either got to be a configuration or a data issue.
Or somebody else made a change.
Oh yeah. So I look through all the different things, right? So I go to the last person who, the person who wrote this test originally, and I say, look, here's what's going on. And she got back to me and she's like, this was later on today. She gets back to me. She's like, I just ran the test and it passed. I had no problems. And I'm like, wait, this doesn't make any sense. And then she's like, but I think I might be using an older version of a dependent library. It's called libgeronimo. And I'm like, okay, I'm running, I think it was 0.454. And she's like, I'm running 0.373. I'm like, that's like 80 versions difference. Right? I'm like, how long ago was 80 versions of this library, right? And every time this library gets bumped, it's a version bump in R in the application that I'm working with, right? So I'm like,
hearing it's that far behind makes me surprised it worked at all.
So I'm like, okay, this doesn't make any sense, because if hers is passing and she's 80 versions behind where I am,
which makes like, no sense,
how could it have passed all the way up until today? I don't understand what is going on. And I'm looking through all the scripts, and I'm looking through all the different, I'm looking through the code and the dependent code, and nothing would indicate this is a problem. And so what it is, what it essentially boils down to is
timestamp.
It's writing an aggregate out to our Couchbase. So it's writing an aggregate and it's applying a tag to it. So this is happening three different tests for three different images, and they're kind of slightly different. So it's testing three different scenarios. The first image is failing and it's saying it can't write the tag because the tag already exists. Second image is successful. Third image fails for the same reason for the first image. Now it's creating these aggregates at the time that it's running the test. So I'm like, well, it would make sense if this was a data related issue. If it tried to write the tag already exists. That's because it was written from a previous test that didn't clean itself up properly. And if that was the case, why is it not cleaning itself up properly now? And why wasn't it a problem yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. But it's creating a new aggregate every time, so that's not the problem. So, like, we're back to if it's not data, and it's not the code, and it's not, like, everything else seems to be fine, what the hell could it be? And you know what it was? This was good. This was good, right? This was why it was passing all the way up until the change that I made.
Okay, let me guess.
And it was passing, and it was failing locally.
Let me guess.
Also. Go ahead.
Typo.
Okay. No, I've seen a similar issue, and it might be the same, it might not be, but we've had code in production for years that's never been touched, and the libraries are evidently based on timestamp. So if you make a change to a piece of code, but you don't completely redo it, and it's been sitting there for 2 or 3 years, and the timestamp changes, so now it's trying to use the brand new libraries, and it will cause a failure.
Well, Joe, no. It wasn't. No, thank goodness, because that seems like it would have been a disaster to try and figure out. But Joel is closer. What had happened, right, was on the version 3 of the library, there's a script that we run called test:integration. And for version 3 of all the pipeline changes we made, I had to add an additional one in there called test integration-CI. And the reason behind that was because what had happened when we went to retaining the image, the test image, and pushing it back up to Quay so it could be reused, we went to that process, like I had said, of mounting the current working directory, which is the repository, into the container as a volume to the container in that directory, so that the application code itself, not the modules that get installed when you'd run a node npm install, would be what's in the repo and what we want to test. We don't want to test the modules. But that's where the problem was. When we build the test container and build the node modules, I move those out of the current working directory into one level up. So node modules exist one level up. And then I put in the container the path for the container when you execute applications or when you log in, that the path to that location.bin for the node modules, which meant that you could then just call the node modules on the command line directly without having to pass in the full path. Now, when we're just doing local development, not in a container, and you do an npm install, node modules is installed in the current working directory at the same level as the root of your repo or the application in of itself. So the path to any of those node modules that get installed, the binary, it creates a inside of node modules directory where all the modules exist. There is a .bin directory in there, which creates symlinks to all the executables that are in those node modules. So because that gets generated locally, do it by an npm install, the path to those module binaries are not in your path. So you have to supply the full path from where you are to that binary to execute it. Now, that required that for executing tests in the containers, we don't have to supply the full path to the testing binary, but locally we do. Hence, we then created two scripts, one for local and one for CI. When I did common v4 pipeline, I reverted all those changes, because what we had to do for our CMS, unlike all our other applications, for our CMS, we had to do a second step, which was to build the static distribution files. Now, building those files one of two ways, one for development and one for production. Production files are minified, development isn't. That's a whole other nightmare we had to solve, right? Talking about testing snafus. When you minify the JavaScript, which was happening in the distribution files, it is significantly smaller. Things run a little faster. But anyway, when it's not minified, it slows things down and causes timeouts very easily. So there's another one, Joe, another issue that we uncovered in this testing. But anyway, so part of the process that I had to do for that CMS application was to an additional step, and that was to build those static distribution files, which could not be done in the container and had to be done on the current working directory. So in order to facilitate that and not have to break all the scripts that were done for that, we had to take for that application, mount that volume, the current working directory repo volume, into the application container and create a symlink in the current working directory to the node modules directory. So when you run the container, node modules symlink exists in the repo, which links back to the node modules one level up, which allows for those static distribution files, the scripts we had created, to be built without having to alter them.
Is that on multiple machines?
This is only on one machine for testing purposes, right? This is only happening. It's one Jenkins slave running one container and doing the test like this in that container when it mounts that volume. So this is not at all how we do production. It's only for the testing.
Okay.
And now I'm getting to the problem, Joe. This is the long ass way of getting to it. So what we did in Common V4 then is we're like, well, we have to do this for Presto. Let's just do it for all the applications, and then we can consolidate it back all into the running the same scripts that we run locally, that we run in the container, and we also run in the Jenkins pipeline. So that was what I was doing with moving everything over to the Common V4 pipeline when I started having this problem with the application. And come to find out, what had happened is when you run the integration test, it does two things. It executes an application called NVault utility. So it's a node vault utility application. So we store all our passwords and secrets and keys and all that stuff in HashiCorp Vault. And so when an application starts up, we have it request that information from the vault to get the usernames, passwords for whatever it needs, and then it pulls it right in to the application. So we don't have to put that in any of our configuration files or in any of our repos, right? That's how we do it. That's one of the benefits of using Vault. So it runs that, gets that, starts the application, and then runs the tests. Well, what had happened was when I did V3 and split out the integration-CI test, it's supposed to be NVault util parameters and then ampersand, then the testing command. But I had it NVault utils parameters testing command without the two ampersands in there. So it wasn't airing out the NVault utility application, but it wasn't running the tests. But it was not causing an error. So for the past like couple of months, at least 80 versions of this application has not been tested in an integration test at all. And that explains why when I did this and fixed that problem by going back to the original one, the test started failing, and it failed for me locally. That just says nobody was ever testing this stuff locally. Is that they were just pushing it up to Jenkins. Because I had said, I'd hit up all these people. I'm like, I can't understand. I had so many, I had like five people looking at this. Nobody was like, they're like, everybody's scratching their head. They couldn't figure it out. And I'm like, wait a minute. If it's not the code and it's not the application and it's not the data, what the hell else could it be? Like, how could the other ones have passed and this is failing? So instead of looking at the failing ones, I went back and looked at the other ones that were succeeding. And I'm like, wait a minute.
We tested wrong.
There's no test executed here. There are no, it's like it's pulling the secrets from the vault. You can see that where it's indicating, hey, I successfully was able to retrieve information from the vault. But there's no tests running. And nobody noticed in like 80 plus versions that. And the one person's like, that doesn't make any sense because people were writing integration tests not too long ago. And I'm like, well, either they didn't test. Well, here was the thing. At some point in those 80 versions, there was a change made to that dependent software, LibGeronimo, that caused this failure. So it could have been either that people had made those changes to the integration tests before that change in LibGeronimo that caused it to break, and then from then on out weren't concerned with running it locally because they weren't testing the tests itself, right? They were testing, making sure that changes weren't causing problems. And the way they typically do that is they do their stuff and push it up to Jenkins. And if it fails up there because it typically runs faster, then they look at the error there. But it wasn't failing because it wasn't running the tests and nobody bothered to look at the successes. They only look at failures. There you go. Fun stuff.
That sounds like you had fun.
I was kind of hoping to get all that stuff done, like, by a little after lunch today so that I can move on to Google Spanner, because my other ticket that I have in my sprint this month is to figure out how we can back up Google Spanner, because we just started implementing that. And if you don't know what Google Spanner is, it's like their database solution, one of their database solutions up in Google Cloud. So I think it's a MongoDB replacement, so they don't have to pay the MongoDB tax, right? You've heard about that issue. So they're working on replacing a lot of their, like, offering similar services, like RabbitMQ messaging service. Well, they have Google PubSub, Solr, they have, like, ElastiCache and other offerings. So I think, like, MongoDB and Couchbase, their solution is Spanner. And so they started using Spanner for something, and they're going to probably adopt it more widely. So we have two problems that I need to explore and solve. Three. But the first two are related. One is, how can we back Spanner up? Because we don't want to lose that data. It's always a good idea to have it backed up. And Google's not going to back it up for you, right? So you've got to figure out what we need to do and what tools we need to pull together to be able to get the data, you know, and back it up on a regular basis. The other thing is that we have – so the implementation of Google, like most things in a company, is – a growing project. It's a living, breathing thing, mm-hmm. right? So what happened when the first few people went in there and they started setting things up, right, is completely different than how we're doing it now, right? So, you know, back in there when they're first getting things going, and a lot of people doing things in the Google console and setting things up, and now, you know, where we're at now is Terraform, completely Terraform, mm-hmm. right? So there's been a lot of, you know, evolution in that whole process, where a lot of things used to be under a certain project, and it was more of a shared project by environment. So our team or our group was not the only one under that project. And to facilitate things and make things better and take more ownership of the overall process, we need to move all our stuff into our own project. So therefore, the Spanner instances were set up under the old project. Now we got to figure out how we can migrate that stuff over to the new project, right? So that's kind of like, how can we get backups going? And is there a way that we could migrate the data, an easy way, or that we can migrate from one project to another? And look into that, because I've never messed with Spanner. It's my first time playing around with it, but that's what I have to do. Figure that out. And I'm kind of looking forward to it. So, you know, that the snafu today took me a little away from that. But
yes, yeah, it's like for the last week and a half, I've been beating my head. They're our company delivers a subroutine that basically allows you to call, you know, you can write your own program to call that subroutine to basically kick off a SFTP transfer. All right, from within the application, okay? So, and they were wanting to use keys, OpenSSH-based keys, okay, or well, it doesn't really matter whether OpenSSH or PuTTY generated them, but you had to generate them in a certain format, okay?
Right.
So, for the last week and a half, I've been troubleshooting. The one error I've been getting was unsupported key format. So, earlier this week, I dig in and I go back to the original e-communities post. This is stuff that our clients have posted over the years. And I saw a little section of it. It was like a directory display that showed the permissions. I thought, this is dumb. Let me try it. All right. I just mirrored the permissions as was in the post. Bam. Worked right away. Nothing in our own documentation or anything. I just went and I just did that, and it worked right off the bat. It's like, and I've been beating my head on it for a week and a half.
Wait, what did you have to do to solve the problem?
Basically, there was a, we have our own, like, we have an e-communities post, which is basically like a community forum, and this is where our clients will share things back and forth. So I went in there, and I basically matched the Octal permissions perfectly on the file permissions for the keys, mm-hmm. and it worked fine.
Oh, okay.
Same keys that I used for straight up command line SFTP. Yeah, though that command line SFTP, I was able to get that working right away, you know, like within minutes of me actually looking at it. But our log was just saying unsupported key format, unsupported key format. I'm like, why is this happening? And apparently that was just one of those little rogue messages, you know, that's what we reported, but that wasn't the actual message, and there wasn't really an actual message that led me to that. I just happened upon it. Documentation is important, people.
How many times did you change the keys before you figured it out?
Fortunately, just once.
Huh?
So, I changed them, and I'm like, I went and regenerated them, and I actually did the generation on my laptop. Sent the other part to the client and say, hey, put this on your server that we're trying to go to from our cloud instance, and they did that. I tried it again. It still didn't work. I'm like, what in the world? I'm like beating my head against it. And then I just said, let me go back to the very beginning and look at these file permissions, and bam. It's like, ugh. And there's nothing in our documentation that says set up your file permission for 644. That's actually what they were for one of them. Actually, the private key was one set of permissions, and the public key was a different set of permissions. Very close. Very close. I think that the public key, I think, had did not have group permissions, and the private key did for some reason. So, it doesn't make sense. I've tried figuring it out. It just doesn't make sense. So, I'll just go back to that community post from now. I'll save that sucker. But it's not often I have to do that kind of stuff for. But when you're migrating into what they call, in our case, we call it AHS, and basically it's just you hosting your application in the cloud, and we take care of a good majority of it for you. But that also lets you bring our costs, any kind of customizations, and that's kind of what this was in the case. And prior to that, they were actually using shell scripts to do the whole thing. At least to grab the files, and then I think they had an application that they will use to actually run the import. But go figure. Go figure.
Were they using SCP when they were doing it from command line?
No, I think they were using SFTP, if I remember right. Still. It's also one of those things, too, where people have got to tell you the truth. And I'm not going to say they didn't tell us the truth, but the question was asked at some point, it's worked on your on-prem server? Did you try it with keys with on your on-prem? And they said yes, it worked. But then I go into a call earlier this week, and they said, oh, no, it didn't work. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because my initial thoughts were, well, if it's working on-prem, let me take a look at your file permissions that way on that server, on your on-prem instance, because they haven't migrated completely yet to the cloud. They're kind of mid-project. And this is just one of those testing bits that we got to do as we go through insurance. So, and tomorrow is working and packing for my little camping trip.
Do you have a lot you have to pack?
Yeah, everything, for the most part. Well, I got packed like you know, clothes and stuff mostly. The camping gear, I got most of the camping gear packed. I still have to buy the food yet, but that's not going to be too bad because I'm really basically, we're looking at kind of one day's worth of food, you know, like a breakfast, lunch, and supper, you know. So, oh, and snacks, of course, but
plus coffee.
Oh, absolutely, coffee. Yeah, actually, this afternoon I was printing a. I'm taking my AeroPress for coffee because it's probably the darn near easiest and most foolproof thing that doesn't require electricity. And I designed and printed a little holder for holding like the paper filters that the AeroPress uses. That way, I don't have to take the. It comes with a holder, but it's not really designed to hold them in place. If it's jostling around in the back of the car, the filters will go all over the place. But anyway, but little things like that, 3D printers are great for. Now, earlier this week, for dinner, I made some steaks. That wasn't today. It was either yesterday or Monday. But I made that, and then I made a keto-friendly key lime pie.
How was it?
It was delicious, actually. The crust had almond flour, coconut oil, and for the sweetener in the crust, it used something called erythritol, which is like, you know, it's like Splenda does called sucralose, right? So erythritol is actually the chemical name for Swerve, which is another sweetener, you know, that's good for diabetics.
Sounds like you're making meth.
Yeah, almost, right? But then that's your crust, and then the actual filling was two avocados, cream cheese, more of that erythritol. I'm trying to think what else was in there. Oh, vanilla was supposed to be in there. I actually forgot to put the vanilla in there. And then the zest and juice from four limes. So you cannot taste the avocado whatsoever. And the only thing is it was not even close to borderline inedible, but it was probably a bit tartar than it should be. And that's because I used regular limes instead of key limes, because I couldn't find any key limes. I just picked up limes. So next time I make it, if I make it with regular limes, I'm just going to make it with one less lime, which will probably help with how tart it was, because it was pretty tart. But I like things tart, so. Because now I'm trying to go to where we're all on the same diet to help both my wife and really myself, because my A1C was borderline, so I want to kind of cut the carbs. Not going to go full keto, but just cut the carbs.
Just low carb. It's better for you.
And damn it, every once in a while I want to eat a hamburger with a bun instead of a lettuce leaf.
Yeah, don't worry. Next time they'll tell you that you need to worry about the processed meats.
Probably.
And then no more hamburger.
My cholesterol was actually better last time. That was before, which I don't know how, but I wasn't taking anything and I didn't really do anything, but anyway, so I'm trying.
What was that you cut out?
Oopsies. Or they also call it like a cloud bread. It's basically, it's low-carb, like, bread-like substance. It's actually made from eggs, mascarpone cheese, and I'm trying to think what else is in it. I think that's it. It's actually fairly, there are only three or four things. You got cream of tartar in there, because what, you whisk the egg whites with cream of tartar first to get nice and airy, and then you mix the egg yolks and the cream cheese, or not cream cheese, the mascarpone. Well, you could use cream cheese, but I use mascarpone, and you mix that together, and then you basically throw it on a piece of parchment, in the bake it for like 300 for about, I think it's about 5 or 6 minutes. I'd have to look. There's a recipe out there, but then you use that in place of bread for your sandwich. So it's really low carb. It actually tastes pretty decent too. So I don't know if I would say it tastes like bread, but it does taste okay.
I just have the hamburger meat.
Yeah.
No bread.
It's like Five Guys will do their burger in a bowl, or they'll do it on a lettuce leaf. And I tried it with the lettuce leaf. I think I'm going to do the bowl next time, because the lettuce leaf was just sloppy, messy. You know, because it's just, especially since Five Guys burgers are just greasy / moist.
Right.
Depending on how you want to call it, whatever you want to call it. Let's just say there's lots of liquid.
Yeah, the leaf doesn't exactly provide any absorption for the grease.
No. If I order go Five Guys again, I'll just get like the bowl. And then I did have fries, but like I didn't have as many fries as I normally would. Just because, you know, damn it, I like French fries every once in a while, you know. It's just not every day that I should eat that, or even every other day.
Yeah, so, I agree with you.
So
I like the occasional thing of French fries.
I went into the frozen section and I bought some of the zucchini spirals, and I tried that in place of spaghetti, and that worked pretty well, actually. I liked it. My son liked it. My wife didn't care for it so much.
For the spaghetti, I tend to get the mixed cauliflower and broccoli, and then use that instead of noodles.
Oh, okay, just the florets.
Yeah.
I haven't tried. I have tried, like, there's people that will take cauliflower and mash it up like a mashed potato. That just doesn't work. I'm sorry.
Right.
Doesn't taste like a mashed potato at all. So, like I said, I can't.
The cauliflower rice is weird.
Yeah, it would be.
To me, rice with a cauliflower aftertaste.
Yeah. Well, it's same thing with the. I'm fine with it, but I got some of those cauliflower pizza crusts. And you get the aftertaste of cauliflower in the crust. And it's okay.
You know, I suppose if there's enough jalapenos on top, it'd be okay.
Or garlic or anything like that,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Or like I used, the last one I made had just regular pizza sauce, cheese, and I used turkey pepperoni versus the regular pepperoni with a little bit less fatty. But just kind of watching that kind of stuff, and sticking more low carb instead of grabbing potato chips. Got a bag of Parmesan crisps from Sam's Club, which is essentially just cheese.
Yeah, should try peanuts.
Yeah,
unsalted peanuts.
Unsalted peanuts, or even salted peanuts, are way better than boiled peanuts. Those are nasty.
Those are.
You ever try those, Dan?
Unsalted peanuts, unsalted cashews.
Boiled peanuts?
No, I've never had a boiled peanut. I've seen them around here, but I've never tried one.
I want to say they're all over the South. Yeah, don't. Yes. It's just nasty. Eat peanut butter instead. I want to get a jar of the natural peanut butter, not standard Jif.
I don't know about the natural peanut butter, but I will get powdered peanut butter, most specifically because my children will not eat my powdered peanut butter.
Well, that's actually a good idea. I have some of that.
And it, you know, if you're making a smoothie or something, it is really good for that.
I've taken that and dumped it on a scoop of ice cream.
Oh yeah, I've done that before too. And the non-dairy ice cream, if you can get some of the lower calorie ones, they're actually really good.
I like
not the coconut ones though.
Halo Top's really good. That's the kind where you can eat the whole thing and it's only 380 calories.
Well, I don't even remember which brand it is that we get. And the freezer's so far away.
And drinking seltzer water.
Oh, I've been... Not seltzer water. LaCroix. I've been drinking LaCroix.
It's the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I can't stand that stuff.
Yeah, it hardly has any flavor.
Can't be worse than that kombucha crap, man. That stuff is disgusting.
Oh, I love kombucha, man.
Oh. It's fucking nasty.
I just made another batch today.
Turns my stomach.
I love it.
Kombucha is just, ugh.
I love it. Joe loves it too, right, Joe?
I have no idea what it is.
There you go.
It's nasty is what it is.
Tastes like ass.
Some people like the flavor of ass.
Reminds me of 330's feet.
I don't know what kind of kombucha you're eating, drinking. Dun-dun.
S. Dave Yates.
Oh, you know what? Okay, so... Like, okay, this is... When I was at a Brigantine, I was in the water, and I was like... I looked over, and there's this guy that looked like Dave Yates.
It was Dave Yates.
No, it wasn't Dave Yates. He's walking around looking like Dave Yates, and I'm like, man... You know what? If we were in the World of Greyhawk or any other Dungeons and Dragons campaign, that guy would be an elf. Dave Yates looks like an elf, doesn't he?
But with the or without the beard.
Either way, he's got that little, he's got that like sly elf look. I wonder what Dave Yates is doing today. Not the
been
keeper,
over a year though. Since we've seen him.
Yes, that is true. Ay, ay, ay. 5150 got another hearse.
Yep.
Oh, you got a second one?
Yeah.
Yep.
According to his MeWe post, he's probably out there somewhere listening right now. He's in the IRC.
That's a little macabre.
Yeah, I'm like... He's got a lot of hearses. He's got two hearses now. Who has two hearses? 5150.
Somebody that's planning on moving a lot of corpses.
Yeah, that. What if 5150 was a serial killer, but instead of like, he just would buy a new hearse every time he kills somebody. They'd just be in the back of the hearse.
Then his body count is still too low to be a serial killer.
That's true. Almost. He's just beginning, man. Come on.
Now I do have a little rant. You probably saw that a couple days ago on
I did MeWe. Read through it. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I've had it for a while now. Good thing is I didn't pay anything for it. It was a review unit. That it's a terabyte hard drive with Wi-Fi built into it, and it has an app. And the nice thing is once Toshiba was done with it, they released the source code. But the bad thing with it is they released the source code, and that's it. No documentation behind it, nothing that tells you how to compile it, nothing that tells you how to build the firmware for it. And there's no community that's formed around it at all. So it's like, yeah, I just have to use it as it is.
Did they discontinue the product?
Yep, it's discontinued, yes.
How long ago did it discontinue it?
I think a couple years ago now, I think.
When did you get it? Just recently?
No, I've had it for probably since they came out. Because it was when it first came out, they sent it to me for a review.
I take it as written in C?
Good question.
R, Pascal, what?
Yeah,
Groovy?
Well, if you look at the code dump, it looks like a whole bunch of things you've probably seen before. So, like, let's see. I'm trying to find my download folder. And let's see here. So, it has a whole bunch of tarballs in it. And it's got things like Bridge Utils, BusyBox, DNS Mass, XPAT. GDBM, HD Parm, iPerf, IP tables, JSON. JSON is specifically says JSON-C 0.9, might be a little old. Libdaemon, libevent, lighthttpd, Linux 3.4.88, mini httpd, mtd utils, PCRE, rsync, Samba, SG3, uboot, udev, wireless tools 29, and zlib.
What is this, a distribution?
It practically looks like it, yeah. I mean, and it looks, and I actually have to see if I download it or copy it on over to my Linux box to actually dig in the tarballs. But they basically just looks like source code dumps from all the pieces of source code. So I think this is a case where it might be that the core is still closed, but these are all the GPL code that it used in the product. And they haven't had an update since like 2015 or 2016, I think. The app hasn't either. You open up the app on my phone. I believe it. I'm trying to think if it tells you what version of Android the app was written for. It doesn't really matter because I'm actually running Android 10 beta 6.
Oh, wait, it's an Android app, huh? It's not just a Linux.
Well, that's the app that's on your phone. Like, for example, you can you can connect your phone to it. In fact, you can back your phone up to the hard drive, which is pretty useful. And the hard drive also has a SD card on the side, so you can plug an SD card in. And by default, it'll just suck the contents of the SD card onto the hard drive, which is kind of nice when you're out shooting pictures. So, and then you can also, like, say there's video on the hard drive, you can also Chromecast the video. Because basically the way it works is it has its own Wi-Fi network when you set it up, but as you're connecting to it with the app, you can actually tell it, I want you to connect to this Wi-Fi network, and once that's done, you can just Chromecast it to anything on your network.
So does this hard drive have a case that it's part of that does this?
Yep, it has a case and a battery and everything.
So the case itself runs the operating system or whatever.
Yep.
That you have the code for.
Yep.
And the only way to interact with it is through that Android application.
No, you can actually use Samba too on network. So like if you have a Windows machine or a Linux machine, you can just look at it just like a Windows file share.
Oh, okay.
So, and there is a web interface to it as well, although the web interface doesn't do much. Basically just gives you some statistics about it and stuff like that.
Would you recommend this type of device in the future?
Probably not. I would probably say go 3D print a case and get you either a USB or some sort of hard drive that you can connect to a Raspberry Pi and build your own. You know, 'cause it'd be far easier to continue to update the Raspberry Pi than it would be to update like a Seagate or a Toshiba product like this. I think Seagate's got one. Well, what's funny is Toshiba's not making anything similar to it anymore. But I think Western Digital still is, and so is Seagate. And some of them even you can buy like a Western Digital MyBook with a network jack in it that can also do USB. So it's the one nice thing about it is like if I'm traveling or something, I could just connect to it directly instead of having to go through my home network, and then I can watch videos on the phone or like on a tablet or on my laptop. So it's a nifty device. I think it it's one of those things where I think that if you're going to open source something, at least provide some sort of directions on how to build the source. So build the firmware.
Don't you have like built-in Wi-Fi in your car?
I do actually. Yes.
So why not just set up a low power server in there and take it with you.
Yep, you could do that. Technically, and it's also got just a standard USB 3 cable, so you can just connect it to your laptop just that way too as well. So even if the Wi-Fi stuff was
just share it with everybody.
Yeah.
At least everybody in the car.
I will say this, it's not secure whatsoever. I mean, there's, it's just several versions behind on a lot of things.
What, the car?
No, this hard drive.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'm not even worried about that. I'm just saying set up a server in your car. And your security when you're going down the road is the fact that you're doing, 75 down the road.
This is true. let's see, I'm trying to see. I did find they also had the source code for the Android app available. So I got it. I don't know much what I can do about it. So then you go into the OSS information portion of the app, and it's got it lists some of the modules. It's JCL over SLF4J. Something called Commons Codec, Jackrabbit WebDAV, HTTP client, Android pull the refresh. I think that's actually some of this stuff's actually in the app itself. A HackyView pager, Universal Image Loader, Cast Companion Library. That's the Chromecast library. Super tooltips, nine old Androids. Fast search index scroller, because it does actually if you're in the app, it actually has some nice buttons, has a picture button, and if you hit that, and it gives you all the pictures for the default user, which that's the only user I use right now. It's the default one, but you can actually technically set up multiple users, but there's no actual lock-in. That's just how you switch from one user folder to another. That's really all it is. But it still works well, but like I said, it's probably horribly insecure at this point. But 9 times out of 10, you're not going to be bothered by that. And most people probably wouldn't be. But I am.
No, it's cool.
And like I said, I didn't pay anything for it, so I'd be a little bit more perturbed if I actually did pay something for it.
My favorite price.
Yep.
The only thing would be better would be if they paid you to use it, right?
Yep. Like, I wish.
No, then it's a job and it loses all its fun.
Like, I wish the folks at Jide would have paid us to be beta testers.
Yeah. No, I meant more in the lines of here you go, here's the hard drive and $100 to go with it. Enjoy.
I do that.
There you go.
Yeah.
The app is called, in the App Store, it's called Toshiba Wireless HDD. And when you look into what's new, it says last updated November 19th, 2015.
Toshiba Wireless
HDD.
And what size is it?
Terabyte.
That ain't so bad.
No, I'm probably going to take my tech loadout for my camping trip. Will probably just be my camera, my drone, my phone, and I probably will take my iPad with me too. Yeah, I got an iPad, so what?
My son has an iPad.
Only reason I got an iPad is because there's not an Android tablet out there that's worth a shit.
$352. I assume this has to be an updated model.
It's probably the same one. Have you seen that on Amazon?
Yeah. Toshiba, Canvio, Aerocast.
Yep, that's the one.
$352, and you got it for free.
Well, I don't understand. It wasn't that when I reviewed it. I guarantee you that.
Right.
I think it's being they're charging that much because people still like them. I don't know, but.
Let me check the other store.
I tried to remember what the original price. Well, actually, you can look at my review and see what the original price was.
Well, for a 1 terabyte, that seems a bit excessive.
Oh, yeah, I was here gonna we say.
Go. Like $35. That seems a bit more reasonable. Oh no. Okay, yeah. $45, $35.
Actually, what's funny is I reviewed it in February of 2015. So basically, they released it and never updated it then. When I got it, it was $149. And 99 cents. That was the pricing of it back then. And the only downside with it is it only has 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi in it. So, if you're
figured you were gonna say, oh, it only does WEP.
No, it does do WPA. So that's good. So. In fact, I think it does WPA too, if I remember right. It's like that monster head, and yet the monster cable folks, they brought out some techie stuff a few years ago too, and I had one that was essentially kind of like the same thing, but didn't have a hard drive. So it had like a memory card slot and a USB port on it and Wi-Fi built into it. It just fell apart. I never could figure out how to get it back together so it would stay together. That's like, I think one of these days I'm going to break down. My laptop bag's still in decent shape, but I've kind of been wanting to get, like, the last laptop bag I'll ever buy.
Yeah, until the next last one.
Yeah, true, but at least this one will probably outlive me. I want to get a, I've reviewed several of their products before in the past. There's a company in Seattle based in Seattle called Tumbin. So not only based in Seattle, but they're made there too. They're made in the United States. And I have, in fact, at least the stuff that I'm taking with me on my camping trip, when I'm putting my clothes in, is Tumbin. Everything is, actually. So I have the Tumbin TriStar and the Synapse the bigger Synapse backpack they have.
How much do those run?
The new one I want to get is about 200, and that's before you add any stuff to it.
Ouch. I tend to prefer to pick up my bags at, you know, resale locations.
But the fabric that Tumbin makes the stuff out of is just TriStar that I'm taking, it still looks, as far as I'm concerned, it still looks brand new.
I picked up a Swiss Gear for a 17-inch laptop. I think we paid like $15 for it, and it was in brand new condition.
That's actually a good price, because I think I paid $50 for my Swiss Gear that I have still. That's actually my current one. I got I will say this though. I probably would hang on to this Swiss Gear and take it with me when I go fly in, because it's the kind where you don't have to take your laptop out of the bag. Just unzip it, and the laptop section flaps down on the belt.
No, this one does it too, where it unzips like basically all the way around except for right at the bottom, and you just flip. Yeah, mine does that.
It's great. So through security, but the thing I like about the brain bag is it's actually got enough space for two laptops in it. You might have to buy what they call, what Tom Bin calls a cache. But the nice thing is you can buy different size caches. So like I could buy one for my Surface, and I can buy one for my work laptop if I wanted to, and fit both of them in the same bag.
Yeah, I think my Swiss Gear bag has had at least two laptops and two tablets at the same time in it.
But I like Tom Bin, though, mostly because, hey, they're made here. And that's
I like part not of the paying $200, but that's just...
True, but if you want to buy made in USA products, you're going to pay for them, generally.
Yeah, usually, yeah.
Right, Pat?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I said if you buy stuff that's made in the U.S., a lot of times it's just going to cost more.
Of course it's going to cost more, but honestly, depending on what it is, it's worth it.
Yeah.
I'd rather have something that lasts than a piece of shit that falls apart after a year.
Yep, I've got backpacks that didn't even last a year. I guarantee you this Tom Bin will probably last 30 years. Easy. And still be good in good shape at the end.
Wait, you bought it? Or you're going to?
No, I'm thinking about it.
For your camping trip? No.
No. I don't need it for that.
Where are you going? Well, wait, you do some traveling. That's
he
right.
says he's packing
on occasion, yeah.
Yeah, you. I was going to say, you work from home. Where are you going? But you travel for work.
Occasionally, yeah. So far only once this year, so.
Right, you went to Florida.
No, it was Pasadena this year.
Oh, okay.
Last year I went to Florida.
Last year you went to Florida and had the tossed salad.
Specifically on their website, my favorite color is they have one they call aubergine, which I call purple. I want different. I like different colors of occasion. I want to have when I buy a laptop bag or something. I like having something that looks different than everybody else's.
That's what patches are for.
That's true. But see, now what I actually slapped some. I got a shipment of. Actually, it was two kinds of coffee, both made by the same company that makes Death Wish coffee. One's Death Wish coffee, and the other is Valhalla Java.
And you in have the to box, give me some Death Wish one of these days.
That's good. Actually, Kroger started carrying it. Kroger's, and I think Walmart does it too.
Okay, well, I haven't seen it at Walmart, and I haven't been by the Kroger's coffee section in a while.
Yep, both in ground and I don't know if they have the whole bean. I'll have to look and see if they have whole bean, because I'd like to pick a pack of that up if they have whole bean.
Yeah, I got a grinder, so.
They got K-Cups, too. So, and that's.
I've heard that the Death Wish K-Cups are the only K-Cups worth having.
I don't know if they're the only ones, but definitely anything that's dark, like the Death Wish coffee is definitely much better than the standard stuff, which is usually weak. Non-existent. Okay, not non-existent, but just weak tasting. Yeah, actually, one thing I kind of wish I did have for the camping trip that I'm not going to have before that is a manual, like a hand crank grinder. I'm just going to pre-grind it before I leave.
Just take a generator with you.
I don't even need to do that technically. Technically, I could just take my grinder because I will have an AC outlet. But
I'm not going to have to with your CPAP machine, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. My site has it. So. Gotta remember to throw the extension cord in the car and some power strips.
No, I remember camping as a teenager. I'd take the camper and I'd take a TV and I'd take my Sega Genesis.
Camping.
Well, hey, there'd be a fire right outside the door and we'd make s'mores and then
although I ain't lying though, a camper or a pop-up is actually looking real damn attractive at some point.
Yeah. But you go out there, you go fishing, and then you take a break from fishing, and you go watch something or play some Sega and get the fire going, make some s'mores, go back, see, and watch a horrible movie or pull the TV outside.
I'm gonna download. Thankfully, Netflix will let you download movies and TV shows onto your iPads and phones and stuff. So I'm gonna fill up my iPad with a. Most likely some Star Trek for the evening. I've been watching. Classic? I'm bopping back and forth between TNG and Voyager.
Anymore, that's classic.
Yeah, it's true. True. I have not watched every episode of Voyager yet. I've watched more TNG than I have Voyager.
I've watched all of TNG. I definitely have not watched much of Voyager.
Enterprise, I think
I've watched all of Enterprise.
I think I got all the way through season one, a little bit of season two. And I cherry-picked some episodes, too, because like, one of the classic Enterprise episodes is the Mirror Universe episode. That was so well done.
And it's like every series have a Mirror Universe episode?
TNG didn't. There was a book for TNG called Dark Mirror.
Okay.
And Counselor Troy was the enforcer character, I think. The one that carries the Agonizer all the time.
Okay.
And according to the book, she was not very covered.
That
I don't know.
Seems to be a common theme in the books.
I don't know if Marina would have not agreed to do that episode.
Probably not.
We gotta start wrapping this up.
Yes, we do.
Bum, bum, bum. Any last words before I play us out?
Words.
All right, we'll see you in a week. Have a safe camping trip, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And you have a great week, Joe, and a great week, Pat.
Have a good one.
And thank you, everybody. Here are your promos. Howard.
Oh, my God.
It's Hacker
Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hi, folks. This is Chatter. Jay Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduk to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, /Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit lhspodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making Egg Foo Young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That pie was pretty good. In fact, I still got two pieces of it. I think there's two pieces of it left. I might go grab a piece in a bit.
What kind of pie was it again?
It's a keto friendly key lime pie. Which, if you like limes, it's pretty good. I like limes. I haven't tried it yet, but I have seen a keto cheesecake, which I do need to try. But trying to make more low carb stuff around the house it's been interesting because I got other things I tried.
Talk about it on the show. Say goodnight to the recording, Joel.
I will.
We ended up going to the pool today, and staying there a little later than I wanted to, so I pushed everything back. All right. How you doing, Pat?
Can't complain.
Where's Joel this week? He said he was going to be here. So are your kids back in school this week, or this coming up Monday, huh?
This coming Monday, yeah.
Wow. Last week.
Oh my gosh, Skylar's been in school for like 3 weeks now.
Yeah, well, you're in Florida, so.
Wait, when does she get out of school though? Like in May?
Yeah, it's pretty early.
Better get this going because you got a deployment to get on. Yeah. All right. This is 8:22. You ready, Joe?
Always ready.
All right. Question for you, Rich.
Yeah?
Do you have stuff that you would like to say? Like, do you have stuff for the show?
Nah. No, okay, I got a video.
All right, because I want to make sure if you did, we got that right away.
Thank you.
Because you said you were going to leave. All right.